a very simple situation of temperature. Now, most of you know that when there is fever, the temperature increases. Normally, our temperature is regulated very well, and our bodies maintain a very specific temperature. But if there is some infection, there could be a slight increase in temperature, and that is known as fever. And we can easily sense fever by putting our palm against the forehead or against the cheek or the throat and so on, or the neck, and sense the temperature, especially of another individual, because there will be a temperature difference. Now, that is a subjective assessment. You will say, okay, you are warmer than normal, or you are really hot, you have a high fever. So you could say, by putting your palm against another person's forehead or neck, you can say that that person has a normal temperature, or perhaps is a little colder due to some reason, or is warm, or has a very high fever. So this grading, colder than normal, normal, warm, and high fever, is subjective. You will not be able to put a number. You cannot say you have 39.2 degrees just by putting your palm, but you could say, as I described now, if that person has a normal temperature or is warmer or colder or has a high temperature. But if you want to measure the temperature, you need a thermometer or some sort of a device. And if you just put a thermometer and measure it at one instant of time, you get one measurement that is a scalar, one single value, let's say 33.5 degrees Celsius. If you measure this every hour or every 2 hours, you can get an array of temperatures. If a patient in a hospital is not well, you may want to monitor the temperature by taking it every hour. You don't take it every minute because you don't expect the temperature to change minute by minute. Maybe half an hour, maybe an hour, depending upon how ill the patient is. Maybe 5 times a day. So there is no need to sample this every minute or every second like other signals. You need to understand how often it could possibly change or how fast it could possibly change. But if you have an array like this, then it becomes a signal as a function of time. So this is f of t, a function of time. So you may plot it. Now, these are actual values from a patient at the Foothills Hospital. From 8 o'clock in the morning till midnight, the temperature is increasing slowly. There is something happening. We don't have to worry what is happening, but just that by making measurements, you can now observe a function of time. Now, you could also do other things with temperature. The whole body has a certain distribution of temperature. We only measure one by either using an infrared detector by measuring the eardrum temperature or putting a thermometer in the mouth. That's one single point in the whole 3D body, three-dimensional body. But if you want to have a distribution of the temperature of the whole body, then it is a three-dimensional function. I'm not aware of any method to get the three-dimensional distribution of temperature in the whole body. You may not be interested in that. But the surface distribution of temperature would be of interest in some situations. In infrared imaging, which is also related to temperature, thermal sensors are used, and the wavelength range of sensitivity is 3,000 to 5,000 nanometers, longer than red in wavelength. And this may be used to capture the heat that is radiated or emitted. So this is passive. So from a distance, you can take a picture. Normally, with a camera, you would take a light image, a visible light image. So what if I use a camera and take a picture, I get the amount of light that is reflected from you, which means that there must be light first shining on you from ambient light, or I have to put a flash, and then I measure the reflected light. But if I use an infrared sensor, I can do passive imaging. A light camera is also passive if I don't use a flash. But if I change the wavelength to infrared, it is possible to get a picture of the heat that is emitted. Heat is also electromagnetic radiation, just like light, just longer wavelength than red. So thermal imaging is a version of infrared imaging. Infrared imaging is commonly used in military purposes for military reconnaissance and monitoring. Now, military technology has been passed on to medical applications, especially in this situation of thermal imaging as a potential tool for the detection of breast cancer. Now, breast cancer is a major issue in several parts of the world, and all available technology has been directed towards this application, including the latest military technology from infrared imaging for thermal imaging for breast cancer. The reason why it is expected to work is that a tumor is expected to be more vascularized or hypervascularized. Tumor will attract more blood, new blood vessels form and attract more nutrients because the tumor is growing faster than the other parts of the body. And because of that, there'll be more blood in the tumor. So it is hypervascularized. And then you expect a tumor to have a higher temperature. Now, this is a three-dimensional body, and a tumor is a fairly small part. Hopefully, it's not too big. The skin surface near the tumor may also demonstrate a relatively high temperature. And in the case of breast cancer and breast tumor, if the tumor is fairly close to the skin surface, then one could expect a change in the surface temperature of the breast. If the tumor is well within the breast, centimeters away from the surface, then it may not be possible to detect temperature differences at the surface. Temperature differences up to 2 degrees Celsius have been measured using non-contact thermal imaging. So thermography, as it's been called, can help in the detection of advanced breast cancer in the case of large tumors that are not far away from the surface of the breast, but they have limited advantages or success in the detection of early breast cancer. So here we have an example of body temperature as a two-dimensional image. I should apologize, I could not make the captions of the figures large enough in this format, but that is in the book anyway. So I expect you to be able to have access to the book to read these details. But anyway, I'll be explaining that. The captions are for me to remember what to say here. So don't worry about that. So here is an example of a thermogram of the breast. Now we have surface temperature. It's a two-dimensional temperature field. So this is temperature as an image. Here there are some variations. This is 30 degrees due to benign cysts, colder than normal. Otherwise, most of these measurements are 33.5 degrees, 32 degrees, and so on. Sometimes there could be what is called a thermal shock applied, where there is an exposure to a cold temperature, somehow a cold temperature is created, and then the recovery is plotted. Here the patient would be in a room, would be acclimatized for a certain duration, so this might be a little colder than the normal temperature one would expect. In this situation, in the area of breast cancer, the temperature is 35 degrees, whereas in a corresponding region in the other breast, it is 33.5. So between these two points that correspond to the same region, from the left breast to the left breast where there is a tumor, the temperature is 2 degrees higher. So this illustrates that temperature that we normally measure as a scalar could be measured as an image. So this is how you could imagine a normal scalar being extended to form an image. We all know how we get light images, so there is nothing new about that, but it is possible to get temperature, surface temperature, as an image, and an application exists here. As I mentioned, this technique has limited success in the detection of breast cancer, but it is a popular technique because of considerations or concerns regarding X-ray dose being an ionizing form of radiation in the case of mammography. So in order to find potential application of non-ionizing forms of radiation, infrared imaging or thermal imaging is one that's been applied in this case. There are other applications of thermal imaging, of skin lesions, of vascular problems in the testes of men. So there is another application there, what is called varicocele, where there are more veins that are bunched together, and there is a difference in temperature there too. So there are a few other applications of thermal imaging. Thermal images serve to illustrate an important distinction between anatomical or physical images and functional or physiological images. If I take a light image, I get an anatomical image or a physical image of just that part of the body. If I take a thermal image, the image depends upon the functioning. So it is a functional image. Without the blood circulating and without the tumor attracting more blood, there would be no temperature difference as we saw just now. So in that sense, it depends upon the physiology and also the pathology, whereas a light image of the breast wouldn't have shown that. So there is a distinction between anatomical or physical images, such as computer tomography, such as X-ray imaging, versus functional or physiological imaging, such as thermal imaging, and certain types of magnetic resonance imaging called functional magnetic resonance imaging. Ultrasound, depending upon the mode used, it could be either physical or functional. So we need to distinguish between the two modalities or two types of investigation. One is purely physical. The other depends upon physiology or function. So a thermal image is a functional image. Okay? Light is also commonly used. I started with temperature because we normally use temperature to measure fever and we sense it easily. So we started with that. Light is commonly used, more commonly used than temperature. But you could use light in different forms. One is reflection, just taking a picture, using a flash or just using ambient light. The other is transillumination, where you let light pass through the body. Of course, we can't do that with the whole body, but you could get transillumination of the breast in some situations. And that's been explored also. It has a few different names, diaphanography or diaphanoscopy. Shining visible light, or in some cases near infrared radiation. You just have to choose the appropriate bandwidth of the electromagnetic radiation that you're using through a part of the body and then viewing the transmitted radiation. So here again it's been explored for the detection of breast cancer, and the fundamental principles behind this are different. Nitrogen-rich compounds preferentially absorb or attenuate infrared radiation. So here, the same infrared radiation that we talked about earlier is used, but now transmitted through the breast, whereas the previous one was just passive imaging of what is emitted. The fat and fibroglandular tissue in the mature breast contain less nitrogen than malignant tissues. And the hemoglobin in blood has a high nitrogen content, and tumors, as I mentioned earlier, have more blood supply and they have more vasculature and hence more nitrogen. For these reasons, breast cancer will appear as a relatively dark region in a transilluminated image. Now, you need fairly bright light to shine through the breast depending upon the thickness of the breast. But it is a technique that's been applied. The effectiveness of transillumination is limited by thickness of the breast by scatter and ineffective penetration through the organ. But it's been found useful in distinguishing between cystic lesions and solid lesions, fluid-filled or solid. Mammography can sometimes be equivocal about these two. Mammography using X-rays may not be useful in some cases to distinguish between these two types of lesions. So typically ultrasound is used, but transillumination has been found to be useful in this particular application. But to detect tumors and to distinguish between malignant and benign masses, this technique has had limited success. Limited success is one way to say that it's not very successful. Rather than saying it is not successful, one would say it has limited success. Okay, let's look at light microscopy for a few minutes. Microscopy is commonly used, has been used for a few centuries now, to examine cells and tissue samples. And magnification of up to 1,000 may be obtained using light microscopes with a combination of lenses. And of course, you will be looking at fairly small samples of tissue or some specimens such as fluids and blood and so on. The resolution that you can achieve in terms of discriminating between fine details is limited by a few different aspects. One is diffraction, the bending of light at edges, and that causes blurring. Astigmatism is due to non-uniformities in lenses. So there could be some distortion because of the nature of the lens, but typically you can overcome that by using a good quality lens. You spend more money and buy a better lens, and you may be able to reduce that or even completely eliminate that. Chromatic aberration is a problem. Electromagnetic waves of different wavelength that compose white light or this yellow light we are looking at will converge at different focal planes, and one point at the source may appear to be a bigger point on the other side that is being imaged, because the different frequencies that make up the light you're using will converge at different points. Now, if you are able to use monochromatic light, then you will be able to overcome this problem. That means you have to use a laser like what I'm using, and you could possibly switch through different frequencies of laser if you are interested in different frequencies. So that is another problem. Spherical aberration is related to the nature of the lens you are using again. The rays of light arriving at the periphery of a lens, if you are using a lens that is thick in the middle and thin at the edges, which is typically the case, in the case of a convex lens, then you have spherical aberration. So the light arriving at the periphery, at the edge of the lens, will be refracted more. So there is a problem in focusing all of these parts to the same focal point. So this causes the rays from the periphery and the axis not to arrive at the common focal point as desired, where you put your film or your detector. So this results in blurring. All of these problems lead to some sort of blurring. You can reduce this by using a lens that is fairly big and then using only a small part of the lens near the focal point, near the central axis rather. That way you assume that the thickness of the lens is the same within the region you're using and you're not using the remainder of the lens. So get a big lens and use only a small part in the middle and you can limit this problem. There is geometric distortion. If you use really bad lens, then there could be barrel effect or pincushion effect, which is due to poor quality lens. Now, by directly looking at samples, the best resolution that most of us can get would be about 0.1 to 0.2 millimeters. Now, I started wearing these glasses about 4 years ago, so I can't claim that resolution without my glasses, but some of you should be able to manage that resolution directly without any glasses. With microscopes, you get an order of, you get three orders of improvement, a factor of 1,000. So from millimeters, you can go to micrometers. About 0.2 micrometer is the limit of detail you can resolve using ordinary light microscopy with good lenses without these problems I have mentioned. So here's an example. We could possibly cut the lights. Can you see this picture okay with the lights on? I don't want to turn off all the lights, which will induce resting and sleeping. So we'll keep the lights on. If there are some pictures that need more attention, then I will turn the lights off. So here is an example of a single ventricular myocyte, a cell from the ventricle of a rabbit. This I got from Dr. Clark with the Department of Physiology and Biophysics at the University of Calgary. He studies contraction properties and other properties of heart cells, myocytes from the heart. And he puts a little microelectrode here and stimulates the cell. He maintains the cell alive in a certain medium, stimulates the cell electrically, and then studies their contractile behavior and other properties. So this is one cell from the heart of a rabbit. The magnification at the microscope is about 600. Now here it's been zoomed, so it is something different. I can't say it is 600, it's more than 600 now. But at the microscope it is 600, and the thickness, this is about 15 micrometers. And you can see some structure, and you can see it contracting and expanding when stimulated. Here are some examples with a magnification of about 300. These are samples of tissue from, ligaments of rabbits. With Dr. Frank, I have done some work on the analysis of the structure of ligaments in terms of the fibers that make up the ligaments and also the blood vessel architecture within ligaments. But this here, you see the nuclei of fibroblasts, these little black parts. They're expected to be well aligned. They're stained in these images to appear dark. This is a 40-week healed tissue sample, which is supposedly close to a normal example. This is a 3-week scar tissue, 3 weeks after injury, a surgically inflicted injury to the ligament. So soon after injury, new tissue will develop, a scar tissue will develop to promote healing of the ligament. And during that period, or in scar tissue, you do not have the normal architecture of ligaments or of collagen fiber, or in this case, fibroblasts. So these fibroblasts here are not aligned. They are in a random fashion. But over time, as the scar heals, the structure is modified to be closer to what is expected in a normal tissue, where these fibroblasts are aligned along the long axis of the ligament, which is, in this case, horizontal. So here, with a magnification of about 300, we can see the fibroblasts, and we can study the general architecture of the ligament in terms of the organization of the fibroblasts. So it's 11:20, let's stop here and we'll take a 15-minute break.